This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The US says the leader of ISIS is dead following a night raid by US special forces in Syria, and it's claiming a major terrorist leader has been removed from the battlefield. President Joe Biden says Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi detonated a bomb, killing himself and his family once he realised he was cornered. North America correspondent Barbara Miller compiled this report.
A group of men stand on what was the third floor of a residential building in Idlib province in northern Syria, the aftermath of a US Special Forces operation to kill the man living there, ISIS leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi, also known as Haji Abdullah. We were woken at 1:30 a.m. by the sound of helicopters, this man says. They were in the air for more than 2.5 hours, and we heard the sound of machine guns. The Biden administration says the operation was months in the planning and culminated when al-Qureshi killed himself, just as his predecessor Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi did when cornered by U.S. forces in 2019.
As our troops approached to capture the terrorist, in a final act of desperate cowardice, he, with no regard to the lives of his own family or others in the building, he chose to blow himself up, not just to the vest, but to blow up that third floor, rather than face justice for the crimes he has committed. Last night's operation took a major terrorist leader off the battlefield.
Local responders say 13 people died, many of them women and children. The Pentagon says it's still compiling its report, but says civilians in the building were given ample time and sufficient warning to leave the compound. ISIS's power has waned dramatically in recent years, and it no longer holds large swathes of Syria and Iraq. But there are concerns it's regrouping, heightened by a recent attack on a prison in northeastern Syria where hundreds of ISIS fighters were being held. So how significant is al-Qureshi's death? Dr. Bruce Hoffman is a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, it's certainly catastrophic in the short term, because I think the precision of this raid will cause ISIS to worry very much about their internal security. And that's always to the good, because it means they have less opportunity to plan external terrorist operations. The question is, how long will that last? And a lot of that will be dependent on who's selected to succeed Haji Abdullah.
The Pentagon says following the explosion, al-Qureshi's identity was confirmed before his body was left at the site. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
More than 600 people in aged care have died from COVID this year, and we've been hearing this week from workers' families and those in care just how the system's buckling under the strain of the Omicron wave. The Aged Care Royal Commission handed up its final report nearly a year ago. Lynelle Briggs was one of the commissioners. She spoke with me a short time ago. Lynelle Briggs, welcome back to AM.
Thanks, Sabra.
Some residents have been locked in their rooms for 3 weeks and even longer. Some are going without care and regular showers because there just aren't enough staff to help out. Is that acceptable?
No, it's completely unacceptable and entirely inconsistent with the approach that we wanted to see happen in aged care in the event that this pandemic continued. What we're looking at in aged care is months on end with no one visiting them and sometimes dying alone. It really shouldn't be allowed to happen, and the government should have sorted a strategy out to how to prevent this happening again.
Do you worry about the mental health consequences for a lot of these people?
Yes, I do. I think that for many people, those with dementia rapidly declining, and those who don't have dementia are just feeling terribly, terribly lonely and is leading to serious depression all round.
The federal government insists that there is no crisis in aged care at the moment. There have been more than 600 deaths. Ministers point out it's much better than what's happened overseas, and that 60% of those who've died were in the palliative phase, and that the overall death rate is 0.1%. Some are saying that is the context, that the sector's performing as well as it can. Does that make it any easier or acceptable?
No, the fact that we're doing better than overseas on deaths in aged care is not the answer. We were quite clear that a life of an older person should be valued equally with the life of a younger person. And we shouldn't be seeing the disproportionate impact on this group when we've known for 2 years that they were particularly vulnerable to the disease. In our report on COVID, we specifically said that there should be a dedicated approach to reviewing the situation of older people and a strategy put in place for the future. There doesn't seem to have been sufficient thought go into that, nor has there been into the question of data collection, which I emphasise in particular in the final report, so that we had a better understanding of the circumstances of people in aged care and we could take sensible policy decisions as a basis for the future, so their lives would be better and their situations not as unsafe as they appear to be now.
The government has offered two $400 bonus payments to aged care staff this week, saying that that's the intervention it's taking right now to help reward and retain people, and it's declined to intervene in the Fair Work case, considering a permanent wage rise. Are you surprised by that?
We were at pains to emphasise in our report that there was a shortage of supply of workers in this sector, that those within the sector were under-recognised, underpaid, under-trained and under-skilled, and that urgent activity needed to occur. And this Fair Work Commission case is a reflection of that. I really think that when we made those recommendations, that was a year ago now, and what the latest COVID problems we've had is to take a bad situation to a crisis. What we're seeing now is that dedicated aged care workers who've been in the system for years are giving up in frustration, and they're going to higher paid and less stressful jobs. And that will continue while we've got the labour shortages that we've got, unless there's government action swiftly to increase wages and train the workers better and provide sensible structured career paths. And I'm hoping that that's what the Fair Commission will actually do. And when they do that, the government will actually have to go along with it and provide those higher wages, because under the system we've recommended, the pricing authority will absolutely have regard to the award and conditions of the workers in the sector. So it seems to me pretty short-sighted of the government to not act now and provide a much higher level of wage increase than these one-off payments that they're making available, which I understand from what I heard the Prime Minister say was, that's it. It's simply not enough to ensure that older people get adequate care.
We are in an election year and a budget is approaching. What are you hoping to see and what is your message to voters?
I'm hoping to see a couple of things, and they're the two big things that we recommended and the government hasn't yet to support. The first is a much better approach to healthcare in the aged care system. And that was to involve a primary care model, which would have been world leading, where general practitioners were paid more to work in the system and were to work as part of a team with a significantly increased nursing and allied health workforce. So that's yet to be addressed. And the other obvious thing is the wage increases and significantly improved training for nurses and care workers in particular in the sector.
Lynelle Briggs, thank you for talking to AM.
Thank you, Sabra.
Former Aged Care Royal Commissioner Lynelle Briggs. In the Northern Territory, overcrowding in remote communities and a lack of supplies means many Aboriginal people sick with COVID are unable to properly isolate or access food. The federal government's used biosecurity laws to restrict people from leaving remote communities for the next fortnight, but some residents in locked-in communities say they feel abandoned and cut off by the wet season. Kirsty Wellauer has the story.
Veronica Adams, the spread of the Omicron variant in her remote community of Palumpa in the Northern Territory has meant isolating in a two-bedroom house with 11 other people.
We're sleeping on the floor. We only got one mattress.
Veronica says at times she and her family have gone hungry, waiting for food deliveries and supplies. Dozens of people have tested positive for COVID-19 in her tiny community, with some residents being flown to Darwin for monitoring and isolation. This is the stark reality that Aboriginal health organisations warned of 2 years ago when the pandemic was declared. In central Australia, the Indigenous community of Umbluddawatch has been isolated by rains and flooding.
Yeah, well, we've been building up stock since at the end of November because we're aware that we can't get cut off by wet weather this time of year.
That's Steve Walker. He runs the only store in the community. Umbluddawatch is in the midst of a lock-in, which means people can move around inside the community but can't travel to neighbouring communities.
Some people haven't got refrigerators or the store food properly as well, so every day they need the store open. So if the store closes, it'll affect the community greatly.
He says the Department of Territory Families, Housing and Communities has supplied funds for hampers for locked-in families. But Mr Walker said he's yet to see any government support on the ground. And as COVID cases continue to rise, the community is desperate to access more rapid antigen tests.
So we've got about 100 RAT tests for 400 people, which is inadequate. The clinic, they've been trying to contact the Chief Health Officer. They've been promised more RAT tests, but the 50 was all that turned up.
The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, told the ABC Commonwealth and NT governments are working with local land councils and community organisations on how best to manage increasing cases across remote communities. Across the border in Western Australia, Aboriginal health services are preparing for borders to reopen. Medical Director at the Kimberley Aboriginal Medical Services, Lorraine Anderson, says they're desperately trying to prevent a similar crisis from unfolding in their remote communities.
We've got staff available to dispatch out to remote communities to boost the staffing numbers in terms of being able to vaccinate as many people as possible straight away, to be able to test as many people as possible straight away, and also just to be able to provide communication and advice to people who are isolating at home.
With hospital beds, ventilators and staff in low supply in remote Australia, Ms Anderson hopes the unvaccinated won't wait until it's too late.
We can care for people in community if they've been vaccinated and they only get mild disease, but we can't care for people in community if they get really sick. People are going to have to be evacuated out of community, and we know that that causes enormous stress, not just to the person being evacuated, but to their family as well.
Lorraine Anderson, the Medical Director at the Kimberley Aboriginal Medical Services, Kirsty Wellauer with that story. The ABC has contacted Northern Territory Health for comment. In a few weeks, the first semester will get underway at most Australian universities. Both students and staff are desperately hoping for a more normal year with less remote learning and a little more campus life. But one thing will still be different. There won't be as many international students as normal, and it's costing the country billions of dollars. Tens of thousands are arriving back in Australia after nearly 2 years locked out, but the sector's warning it will take a long time to recover. Tom Lowry has more.
In February 2020, international student Katrina Ha arrived at the Australian National University in Canberra, looking forward to 4 years of study. 3 months later, she was back home in South Korea as COVID closed borders across the globe. When Australia's border reopened to students 6 weeks ago, Katrina was on the very first flight.
Border opening date was 15th of December, and then I arrived in Sydney Airport at 8 a.m. on 15th of December.
She's one of 56,000 international students that have arrived back in the country since November. 7,000 arrived last week when the federal government started refunding visa application fees to encourage students to return. The government says the figures show Australia is open for business, welcoming students along with backpackers and skilled migrants. Uni doesn't start for a few weeks, But Katrina is loving being back.
I'm meeting all my friends in Australia right now. Like, so just meeting them is also like already happy for me, even though I'm doing nothing other than that.
But not everyone is returning. Katrina says some friends that started in 2020 gave up waiting for the borders to open and took opportunities elsewhere.
I know some of them like transferred to Canada, or like one of my friends also transferred to Europe or the United States.
Phil Honeywood is the head of the International Education Association of Australia. He says the sector will take a long time to rebuild.
There's a lot of confusion in the marketplace about what's the motivation for Australia wanting these students back. Is it just to provide a supplementary workforce?
In 2019, international education was worth about $40 billion to the economy. New trade figures released yesterday revealed that's nearly halved, down to about $22 billion last year.
And that has major economic impact upon accommodation, tourism, obviously food, entertainment, and education providers' tuition income, which cross-subsidises domestic students.
But others are seeing green shoots. Katrina Jackson from Universities Australia says the number of student visas being approved provides plenty of reason for optimism.
If we're seeing a 50,000 increase in visa approvals, that means 50,000 people are saying, hey, wow, I've decided to study in Australia.
Katrina Ha says it's been a long wait, but it's worth it.
Everyone really feel happy, happier than like last year.
International student Katrina Ha ending that report from Tom Lowry at Parliament House. Once-in-a-generation rainfall across large parts of inland Australia has cut off communities and caused major disruptions, with roads and rail lines washed away in floods. Food and supplies being flown into stranded towns, and it will prove a problem for Western Australia too, with the main rail line to the west cut. Yet it's not all bad news. Scientists say the deluge has recharged vast ecosystems that have been enduring record-breaking dry spells, and it sparked an explosion of plant and animal life that will keep researchers and nature lovers busy for years to come. Matt Bamford reports.
From the veranda of this house on the Eyre Peninsula, the full force of South Australia's summer drenching is on display. Large parts of regional Australia are recording their biggest downpours in years. Widespread flooding has damaged crucial road and rail links and left some communities isolated. But not everyone is complaining. In Victoria's Barmer Forest in the Murray-Darling Basin, locals are voicing their appreciation. It's the start of what Professor David Watson says will be a stunning transformation for many inland ecosystems.
Insects, birds, they all flock to these areas, sometimes within hours. And so now the sound of frogs at night is almost deafening. It's amazing to see.
The Charles Sturt University researcher says rain events like this only occur every 10 to 15 years. And while he can't reach these inundated areas yet, he has other ways of observing.
So we've got acoustic listening stations that we've put, you know, hundreds of them around inland Australia. So they're there now, recording data right now, as I'm chatting to you. Frogs, birds, bats, goats, all their squawks and squeaks are being recorded.
Native plants will also be on the rebound.
This is sort of a hallmark of semi-arid and arid ecosystems. These long periods of not much, punctuated with these relatively short periods of intense activity.
Dr. John Reid lives on the Eyre Peninsula and has documented major inland flood events for decades.
2018 and 19 were pretty much the driest two-year period throughout a lot of central Australia on record. And we can also tell a whole lot of really old trees, old pine trees and sandalwood trees and myall and mulga trees that are centuries old, they died in that drought and the heat wave. So it has been really dry, and this is very welcomed rains.
But while native species are expected to thrive in these favourable conditions, so too will pests.
We'll have a lot of house mice. Whether they plague or not, we're not sure, but they're definitely, their numbers will increase. And animals like the plague locust, their numbers will increase as well, and they're challenges, but it's part of the natural system.
While much of inland Australia remains cut off for now, John Reid says there'll be a rare opportunity in the months ahead to see the interior at its best.
Yeah, it's just some amazing opportunities coming this autumn and winter, and even next spring. There'll be an amazing show of wildflowers, and there'll be hundreds of thousands of waterfowl accumulating on some of the local lakes and swamps and things, and breeding up massive flocks of budgies and zebra finches, and yeah, some of the scenery will be fantastic.
South Australian ecologist Dr. John Reid, ending Matt Bamford's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the podcast ABC News Daily. Federal Parliament's back next week, and while Scott Morrison had hoped a press club address would reset the stakes, it's only worsened his already tenuous position. Today, 7.30's chief political correspondent Laura Tingle on the parliamentary sitting days Scott Morrison doesn't need, his reluctance to say sorry, and a tough road ahead. Look for ABC News Daily on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.